Hello and welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Inside Education is the programme that brings you insights into teaching, learning and all aspects of education from an Irish perspective. My name is Sean Delaney and you can listen to or download podcasts of previous editions of Inside Education on insideed.com. Last week on the programme I brought you an interview with Stephen Murgatroyd, who was born in England but who now lives in Canada. This week's guest also has a Canadian connection, but her journey has brought her in the opposite direction. On this week's programme, I'm bringing you an interview that I recorded with the head of education at Maynooth University, Professor Sharon Todd. Sharon Todd is originally from Montreal in Canada, and she spent time as an academic in Canada before moving to Sweden, where she took up a post at Stockholm University in 2004. She's been in Maynooth since 2014 and she's interested in education practice, policy and curriculum and has a commitment to pursuing social justice through education. When I met up with Sharon Todd at the Enerdelm conference in September, I noted that the title of her keynote presentation at the conference was Socially Just and Ethically Responsible, Educational Leadership as a Relational Practice. So I began by asking her first to tell me what she meant by describing educational leadership as a relational practice.
What I'm trying to get away from, I think, is the assumption that educational leaders hold sort of individual values and that they bring those to very particular contexts. Instead, I'm wanting to see that it's the context that's itself that actually informs what good leadership can be. And so seeing that the relationships that a leader has with parents in the community or and the teaching staff and the students actually begins to matter to the kind of work that they do. And it actually matters in constructing a vision for the school. So it's not the case that, and you know, the talk was framed around the theme for the conference, which was that kind of leadership is sort of future focused, is that we need to focus also on what's happening in the here and now. So not just seeing that our relationships to our colleagues, for instance, are a means to an end, but are actually an end in themselves. And they actually can, it's upon that basis that we can start building a common view of the future together.
So what are the implications then for a principal who is, say, embarking on their role? Because you're kind of saying it's not so much about your mission statement or all of those other things, but it's about how you're actually going to be with all the different parties that you're going to relate to.
That's right. I mean, in some ways, mission statements can be very important for consolidating, I think, one's thinking about a certain issue, about where they see the school going, the direction they want to take with their staff in order to sort of reach some kind of common purpose in the school. And so I don't want to minimize the importance of that. But at the same time, I think that we need to start seeing that those relationships are not just ways of getting and achieving the mission, but actually are suggesting or can be suggestive of changing the mission, so that the mission isn't something that's written in stone, but becomes a lived reality where people feel that they belong, where what is being communicated to them is something that they own and they also take ownership over. So I think that what relationships, focusing on relationships does is that it creates an environment where everybody can be who they need to be instead of a leader coming in and saying, this is what you need to be in order to get us to this goal. And I think that creates very different kinds of working conditions and it creates an atmosphere of openness and inclusion.
But is it in conflict with the theme of this conference, which is future-focused? Because if you're future-focused, you're not necessarily focused on the relations that you're having with people in your community right now.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think that what I'm suggesting is that although the future is important for giving us some kind of hope, we need to build that together through the relationships that we have now. And I think that what often happens is that when we have a goal of the future, say of social justice or total equality, we forget sometimes that we need to accept the situation in which we're working. So, and by accepting, I don't mean agreeing with or acquiescing to. I mean that we need to name the situation for what it is. So, for instance, if we see some kind of racist sort of behavior going on, we don't just sweep it under the carpet in the name of, oh, well, that will be sorted out once we start working towards our future goal of equality. But rather, we accept the situation for what it is. This is a racist incident. We need to name it and build relationships in the present that actually are responding to that situation. So it's not that, you know, the future isn't important, but it grows out of what we have together, as opposed to somebody defining a future for me that then I'm supposed to live and be in a particular way. And I think that, you know, when we take our making sure that we are respectful of each other, that we live well together in the here and now, then it makes it a lot easier to form a vision of the future that is actually much more cohesive and inclusive.
Does it become more difficult for a principal then if they're trying to behave in a relational way because they're constantly being tugged at by different people? Mm-hmm. And how do they then go about prioritizing things that really matter for them in the running of the school?
Well, that's a very different... I mean, I myself am head of department, and so I face that question almost every day. I think that what has struck me is that when people relate well together, that you can solidify and cement relationships, what happens is that the value gets placed not so much on what it is that you want to be in the future, but really the relationship itself. And sometimes what I myself go back to is, if I make this decision, what effect is this going to have on the relationships that I've built up with my staff, for instance? And it's from that perspective that I make the decision, or at least I try to, you know. No, I'm definitely, like everybody else, not perfect. But I think that it's the position from which you start that I'm questioning. So it's not the question of whether, you know, the future is unimportant or anything like that. It's more the position from which I begin to ask those questions. So the decisions that I make and how I'm getting pulled and tugged all over the place, as a school principal is, and having to be accountable to very different bodies, you know, politically and within the larger school system and with the parent body, as well as the students and the teachers, I think that asking themselves from what position am I going to be making my decision from is absolutely crucial. And what I'm suggesting is that relationships actually become part of that central position from which we do that.
What kind of ethical dilemmas do leaders in education face?
Well, they face numerous ethical dilemmas. I suppose one of the issues that I can speak from experience and also from talking to school principals is conflict. Conflict itself poses an ethical dilemma. Because it raises questions about, I think, why do I perceive this as a conflict? Is it because somebody is going against something that I hold dear? Is it because I value something and somebody else doesn't value something? How do I handle conflict of a intercultural, perhaps, nature in ways that respond to the parental community, the student, and the teachers in a respectful way? So I think that, for me, it's the dilemma itself. It's not the content necessarily of the dilemma. It's actually the dilemma itself that creates the anxiety, because you don't know. There are no answers. There's no textbook. There's no checklist. There's nothing that can tell you what the right response will be. The only response, and the only people that can tell you what the right response is after the fact, is after the fact. And that's the people that you're actually making the decision either on behalf of or with. And I think that it's that fear of conflict that I think is the most difficult one for a leader to face.
So how then can a leader provide ethically responsible leadership?
Well, as I said, I think it becomes the position from which you're centering and you're seeing your role. So if you see your role as being a representative of the Department of Education and Skills or something into the school, then you set up another kind of system in the school that will lead to a certain kind of leadership style. If you see yourself as starting from the position of what I value most are my relationships to the community, to the teaching staff, and to the students I work with, then you're going to end up in a very different place. Now, that's not to say that it's perfect. That's not my suggestion at all. You know, like life is messy and imperfect. But I do think that what ends up happening is that you start seeing the world in a slightly different vein. And you actually have much more opportunity for bringing people with you than if you see yourself as a representative of some authority.
So how then does a leader balance pragmatic demands with ethical principles?
The thing is that you will always experience periods and situations where you are out of balance. And, you know, I've made them, and I can really only speak from my own perspective on this, I feel. But I've learned over the years that you can always go back, and you can't undo what you've done, but you can always talk about what you've done and apologize for it. And I think we don't have a culture enough where we see that openness around these things actually gets you really far in terms of developing relationships with people. So I think that being able to say, I maybe mishandled that, I maybe misjudged that, or maybe I didn't listen to you because I was in a hurry. You know, I had this parent on the phone and that kid pulling at my leg and this teacher demanding something. And yeah, you're human. Of course you're going to make those things. But to be able to go back and have that kind of relationship with those people that you can actually talk about that, then I think you're a fantastic leader. You know, I think that can really, really be something that's achievable for everybody.
In the past, in Ireland, for example, ethics would have been informed very much by religion. Mm-hmm. But in an era when religious observance is declining in many countries, mm-hmm. what informs ethics in such a climate?
Mm-hmm. For me, what has to inform ethics is, and you know, and of course I've been talking a lot about ethics as being a relational issue. And that's built on a number of philosophers that I've been reading over the years who kind of put forth the idea that it's really about being open to the other, that's what ethics is. Ethics isn't about having a code of a set of principles that you internalize and then enact on the world. That can help you in certain kinds of situations, but that isn't what is That's more sort of a values-oriented, or perhaps morality might be the word that better covers that kind of understanding of ethics as being about principles. What I'm suggesting here, and it's based on my reading over the years, is that what becomes important is the degree to which those relationships actually remain open and attentive. Even as we walk into a classroom, when we walk into a meeting, we are already in an ethical situation because we are responding to others' needs, other different ways of seeing the world. Seeing ethics in this way, as a practice and an attentiveness to otherness, actually it gives me at least a different kind of model for thinking about social justice and inclusion. So it gets away from this community holds these values, this community holds these values, and don't those values clash? Well, actually, they might on paper, but when you actually sit down to talk to somebody, it's not the values that matter, it's the relationship that you have, and it's the things that you do together. So I think that doing things together, like building up a school culture, actually gets you away from trying to describe beforehand what values we need to hold in order to have some kind of communication with each other. For me, it's the other way around. Communication happens in the doing, and whatever values fall out of that, they fall out of that.
Okay, so if we continue that idea of ethics as being responsive, mm-hmm. I mean, let me give you a scenario. Supposing a student comes up to you and seeks an extension of a deadline mm-hmm. for an assignment. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you're responding to that student, you might kind of say, okay, you know, maybe they've, you know, had a tough time at home or something, and you're going to give them an extension. But then there are other students who might well have benefited from an extension mm-hmm. and who haven't got it. So by responding, couldn't it be unethical in some ways if your ethics are constantly guided by just responding to a given situation?
Exactly. And this raises the question of the difference between ethics and justice. So ethics is very much based on this kind of, if not one-to-one, but this more personal level, which mostly we've been talking about. But justice actually is about that kind of fairness, a much broader sense of not treating necessarily everybody the same, but treating everybody equitably. And that means sometimes recognizing their differences in order to treat them equitably. So I'm not going out from the position that everybody needs to be treated exactly the same way in order for everybody to be equal, but actually quite differently, that we actually need to respond to the differences in order to be treating people equitably. However, what we're always balancing as teachers is really a question of judgment, professional judgment, and school leaders as well. We're bringing in sort of judgment that's always going to sort of, the philosopher Derrida calls it a betrayal of ethics. So as soon as we start having to compare or prioritize what we're doing, we're betraying somebody in that process, because we cannot possibly respond to each individual meaningfully in the same way. So yes, there will be those kinds of decisions. But the question for me always becomes, again, from what position are you making that decision? And is it sometimes, does it become so abstract that we're holding on to a principle that it has no meaning anymore in anybody's life? And would the other students who didn't get the extension be that upset if they themselves found out it was because, you know, the child had a bereavement or, you know? So I think that sometimes adhering to principles, we're always making judgment calls, and we make mistakes in those judgment calls, and we hurt people in those judgment calls. But I think it's an ongoing process. But again, I just want to emphasize that we need to always come back to that and recognize that maybe my judgment today is not going to be equitable for everybody. It's not going to be treating everybody the same, and maybe it will.
You've had a very interesting background in terms of your engagement with education systems in different countries like Canada, Sweden, and now Ireland. To what extent do you believe education is the same across countries, and to what extent do you believe it differs?
It's very similar in the sense that I feel that educators in those three contexts that I've worked in most closely, educators feel that they don't have enough of a voice when it comes to policies and decision-making. Now, I left Canada about 13 years ago, and things have changed there quite considerably, so I don't feel qualified to really comment so much on that. But in terms of the European context, what I see more and more is a kind of what I'm calling a Eurovision of education, and everything is just getting flattened out across the national context in order to achieve certain kinds of performance goals. Everything needs to be measured. Everything is reduced to skills and competencies. I think in both and talking to my colleagues across Europe, but particularly in the systems that I'm most familiar with, Sweden and Ireland, in the European context, people are feeling that there is such a top-down approach, and that education is conceived of as being very, very thin. And really, people do not usually get into education because they just want to teach skills and competences, but they actually want to shape a person's life, help them on their journey, make a difference to people and to society. And when we have these kinds of Eurovision kinds of projects, people feel disenfranchised, they feel alienated from their work. And this is something that I've seen grow over the last 13 years since I've been in Europe. I think one way of thinking about that is giving much more autonomy to the teaching profession in order to develop their curricula that actually responds to the needs of the students with which they're working, in ways that are not so performance-oriented. that they don't have to test the kids to death. I think it alienates youth from a very early age in terms of schooling and what education can actually mean and do for them, because they then see education as only a means for getting a technical means for getting a job. And of course, education should think about, you know, what the future is going to hold in terms of what your career possibilities are. But that certainly should not be the only measure. And so I see this tendency of sort of making education much more technically oriented as really depriving people of their right to an education that actually, you know, broadens their horizons, that gives them opportunities for thinking differently, that allows them to explore other avenues of perspectives, other avenues of thought. So for me, I think that's the one trend that I see that is pernicious, I think, across the European context right now. On the other hand, where I see Sweden has actually bought into that model quite a bit, I see that there's a window of opportunity in Ireland to do something different. I see that there's change happening in society. I see that people are getting a bit disillusioned with what education has been, where it could go, how we need to address, you know, the issues of around homelessness and youth disaffection. And how we do that, I think, is actually thinking outside the box. And we cannot follow the Eurovision project entirely. I think we need to be a little bit more circumspect, a little bit more a bit more out there. And we're small enough here. We can do something different. We can slide under, you know, these kind of Eurovision rules and regulations that operate. And I think we should take that opportunity to do so.
So what do you think then we need more of in our schools in order to get away from this flattening of the education endeavour and to make it richer?
I think we need to have a different model. I know patronage is a huge issue in the Irish context, and we actually need to have many more schools that are going to be responsive to the actual communities that they're serving, which I don't see happening enough here. I think that there needs to be much more attention paid to economic issues and intercultural issues. And I think schools need to be proactive in engaging with those issues in meaningful ways, not just giving lip service to, yes, you know, this needs to be done and, you know, I will tick all the boxes. And yes, we have a very diverse student body, for instance, so that's great. But actually engaging students in their own life projects, to put it that way, and finding ways of developing curriculum. Transition year curriculum is actually a really interesting Irish kind of invention, if you will, that actually allows students to explore other possibilities for themselves. That's what education should be about. It's not just about sitting kids down, getting them to memorize a whole bunch of facts for tests. We do that way, 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 way too much. And we're seeing the results of it with high issues of unemployment and youth disaffection and alienation from the school system. So I don't think we can afford to keep going down that path that apparently the European context thinks that's the way to go. But then again, the policymakers often are actually serving social and economic interests and not education interests.
A lot of the changes you've described there are structural rather than curricular. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a need for a richness of curricula as well?
Absolutely. I think a curriculum plays an important part, but unless you're going to change structures, curriculum can actually fall quite flat. And unless you're going to engage teachers as professionals, again, it's going to fall flat. So the question that I think that's really important to ask is how can we create a professional context for teachers that's meaningful and that doesn't punish children and adolescents with, you know, multitude of tests that actually are not educative in and of themselves. So I think I see that curriculum is actually one of those pieces that bridges those two questions. But without some structural changes, you know, curriculum has a little bit of a difficulty of holding fast, and it can be perceived as the, you know, the secondary teacher unions in this country have perceived it as being a top-down, which was unfortunate, I think. Terribly, terribly unfortunate, because this was actually an opportunity to perhaps do something different. But it has to happen within the context of teacher autonomy as well, professional autonomy, and an eye towards changing the system so that it makes it much more open and creative and innovative for students.
You've been in your position now as professor in Maynooth for just over a year, is mm-hmm. that right? How are you settling into the work of being professor there?
Oh, I love it, actually. It's been a very good move for me at the right time of my life. When I came to Ireland, I just felt that things were kind of in alignment for me in one way, and partly because I saw that education is important here in the country. There's a window, as I said, of opportunity to do something, I think, here. There's like a zeitgeist that people are wanting change to happen, and it's a great place to be when you're sensing that that is what is happening. And secondly, also the university that I work for, Maynooth University, puts education sort of at the center of its strategic plan. So often within a university structure, professors of education have to argue for the importance of education as an academic discipline, whereas at Maynooth I haven't had to do that. And I think that that has made that transition for myself easier. And on a very personal level, things have just been quite easy. People are very friendly and accepting, and I've had great colleagues to work with. So it's been a very, very good year, and I hope the honeymoon kind of continues.
Have you had the opportunity to visit any Irish schools?
Yes, I have, actually. I've visited mostly in the Maynooth area, actually. So
what struck you about them?
The schools that I visited in, they were all, of course, wearing uniforms, which is, and I know that sounds like such a superficial kind of comment, but it was very interesting for me coming both from Canada and Sweden. The other thing that was interesting for me, the first classroom that I sat in, it was a girls' school, and you couldn't hear a peep in the classroom, and I just thought, wow, are all Irish, you know, secondary schools like this? But I've been assured, and I saw later, that no, that wasn't the case. They're more like the Canadian and Swedish schools I've been to.
And that was Professor Sharon Todd from Maynooth University bringing this week's Inside Education to an end. Thanks to Sharon Todd for her time and to Tim Hurley of Enerdelm for setting up the interview. You can listen to or download podcasts of previous Inside Education programmes on insideed.com. You can get in touch with the programme by writing to me with feedback or suggestions to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.